அன்னை அன்பர்கள் அனைவருக்கும் எங்களுடைய இனிய காலை வணக்கங்கள். ஸ்ரீ அன்னை பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் தவ திரு அப்பா கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதார விந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இன்றைய லைஃப் டிவைன் வெப் மீட்டிங் நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். இன்று மிஸ்டர் சந்திரசேகர் அவர்களும் மிஸ்டர் கேரி ஜேக்கப்ஸ் அவர்களும் இந்த லைஃப் டிவைன் ஸ்பீச்சை துவங்க இருக்கிறார்கள். தி டாபிக் வந்து The evolution of the spiritual man. Now I am inviting Mr. Gary to deliver this speech.
Sri Aurobindo starts this chapter, the evolution of the spiritual man. He starts it in an unusual way by asking us to imagine a situation. Imagine that we were visitors to Earth, maybe some 5 billion years ago. What would we have found? We would have found a dusty, empty planet with mountains, deserts, volcanoes, oceans, lakes, and absolutely nothing on it. What would we have thought? Except for the water, it would be like going to the moon today or going to Mars, where there's absolutely nothing there but stones, rock, sand, hills, valleys. In Mars and Moon, there's not even any water, not any bodies of water now, though there may have been at one time. What would we have thought of this planet? What would we have thought of the purpose and aim and future of the universe? Then he asks us to imagine back some billions of years later, maybe a billion years ago, where we would have noticed, a visitor would have noticed, the first signs of life. Some moss is growing, some algae is there in the ponds, some small grass is growing on the land. What would we have thought of this planet, of this world, of its future? What could we have conceived of what purpose it might have, what value it may have, what future it may have? And then if we came back again sometime much later, we would have found a planet teeming with life in all its descriptions, from the tallest trees and thousands of varieties of flowers and plants and fruits and vegetables and grains and moving creatures, insects, birds, fish in the ocean, mammals on the land, reptiles of all description. What would we have thought? What is this all about? Where has it come from? Where is it going? What meaning could it possibly have? And then some hundreds of millions or years later, we come back and we find the world as it is today, with human beings everywhere, not just spread everywhere. They're flying in the sky, sailing on the oceans, building mountains out. Their buildings are become mountains. They're living under the ground also. They're moving rapidly. They're constantly inventing and creating one thing or after another. What is the meaning of all of this? What is the purpose? What is the future? What is the destiny? Even today, the scientist who knows all of these things, knows all that happened in the last 5 billion years since the Earth was created, at least in some rough outline, some idea. What does he understand of the purpose of the universe, of the purpose of the Earth, of the future? He still doesn't know what it means. If you talk to the social scientist, you ask him, where is it going? What does this mean? What's the meaning of it? No, the psychologist will say, no, man is pretty much the way. Man is an animal. He's a thinking animal. Somehow life has come out of the material elements, and somehow life has begun to think, and man is the thinking animal. But essentially, the man today is the same as the man was thousands of years ago. Oh, we have machines now. We have more technology. We have more science. But fundamentally, the human being is the same as he was at the time of the Vedas and Upanishads, or Greece and Rome. So what meaning does it all have? What purpose does it all have? Oh, he will say, it's true, our society is advanced. We have more knowledge, we have more technology, we have more prosperity, we have a lot more people. We have banks and credit cards and cell phones and so many things. But essentially, what's the future? We'll have more technology. We'll be living longer lives. We'll have more food, hopefully, if we don't destroy the planet. But what is the meaning of it? What's the purpose of it? Still today, the scientists can't tell us what that purpose is. The scientists can't tell us why we have come this far, how the vacant planet, the deserts and mountains became teeming with life, and how those teeming life have given rise to thinking, feeling, talking, creating human beings, and still science has no vision of the future. There are a few who have grasped something beyond. They have said, mental thinking man is not the end of the line. There's something more. There's something more. There's another reality that we don't see. Beyond the matter, beyond life, beyond mind, there's something more. It's called spirit. The scientist says your spirit is only a thought in the mind. You think of something, you think of romance, or you think of spirit, or you think of adventure, or you think of being very rich, and you believe it's true. But spirit is only a thought in the mind or a feeling in the heart. You think you love your wife or your husband or your children like that. It's all chemicals. It's all hormones. Your idea of spirit is like that. But in every country, in every tradition, there are people who have said, no, it's not like that. Spirit is not an idea. Spirit is not just an emotion. Spirit is a reality. But even in Indian tradition, which has known the spirit more than any other, the conclusion that the rishis, the yogis, the sages, the saints came to was, spirit is dead. We are here. We have reached the end of the evolutionary line. We have come as far as nature can come. How nature came this way, we don't know. How the stone has become the plant, and how the plant has become the animal, and how the animal has created man, we don't know. But we're the end of the line. There's something more. But it's not here, it's there. So our job is to go from here to there. We must seek moksha. We must seek liberation. That is our destiny. Sri Aurobindo says, matter, life, mind, and spiritual realization are not the end of the line. He talks of spiritual evolution. What is spiritual evolution? He talks of evolution of the spiritual man. What does he mean by that? Well, he tells us, so actually the evolution of life out of matter is a spiritual evolution. It is only the spirit that is there in matter that has become life. The evolution of the animal out of life is a spiritual evolution. The evolution of thinking man out of animal, feeling animal, is an expression of a hidden spiritual potential that's there. But he says, mind is not the end of the line. Man is not the end of the line. There's something more. What is that evolution of the spiritual man? What is that process of spiritual evolution? What's next? And what's beyond that? This is the subject of life divine. This is the subject matter of the last 20% of the book. It's only some 5 chapters, but the whole future. As Appa has said, life divine is the horoscope of the universe. In the next 5 chapters, Sri Aurobindo casts the horoscope for the whole universe, for the whole of humanity, for all of us, and for all that's to come in future. Well, in this chapter, he wants us to understand how we are evolving, how we are trying to evolve, and starts to tell us what the future will bring. Starts to what we could not imagine going back 5 billion years or 1 billion years or 100 million years or 1,000 years or today, what we will see in future. But how do we move? How are we trying to move? And he tells us that we are using 4 powers, 4 ways in which humanity is trying to evolve to something beyond itself, trying to find something greater. He says there are 4 things we have to do to evolve, and there are 4 methods or aids that we are using in order to make that progress. He said first is we have to know that there's something beyond us. We have to know that there is something called spirit, God, divine, truth, Brahman, whatever it is. And humanity has invented religion as a means of relating to that higher reality. Second, we must know something of the hidden powers of our own being. Today, we are helpless before nature, before the world around us. But the future is that we should discover the infinite power in our own beings. The powers of our life, the powers of our mind, the powers of the spirit in life. Whereas tradition says we must escape and go elsewhere, Sri Aurobindo says no. We are to be, the future is to have mastery in life, is a divine life. We must know those powers. And occultism is the process, is the method that humanity has tried to use to discover what those powers are within us and how we can gain that mastery. We must have knowledge, and our highest instrument of knowledge today is mind. So we must have some understanding where we have come from, how we have come, where we're going, what is our destiny, and how we get there. Because mind is our highest instrument, so we need knowledge. We need an intellectual knowledge in order to get there. But he tells us none of these three, religion, occultism, or intellectual knowledge, is sufficient. We need something else. We need spiritual experience. And in this chapter, he talks about these four aids, these four methods by which we are trying to ascend, to lift ourselves out of the humanity, the human conscious in which we are today, and rise to something higher. Start on this path of conscious spiritual evolution, because up until now, all the evolution before human beings has been unconscious, subconscious. It's nature's evolution. But now we have an opportunity. We have an aspiration. We have a sense that there's something beyond us that we should seek. And the methods we have devised or discovered, our religion, occultism, our intellectual quest for knowledge, philosophy, and spiritual experience. First, religion. What is the essence of religion? What is the power of religion? What is the limitation of religion? How are we, as devotees of Sri Aurobindo and Mother, using religion as a means for our ascent? How far will it take us? What are its limitations? How far have we understood what they're really saying? Or how far have we simply taken integral yoga as another religion instead of worshiping Shiva or Krishna or Jesus or somebody else? Now we are being Buddhists or something else, or Muslims, Jewish or whatever it is. So we are devotees of Sri Aurobindo and Mother. Have we really understood the place of religion, what they have told us about its future and how it's to be used? And how it's to be transcended. He tells us that faith is indispensable to human endeavor. We cannot do anything without faith. We cannot get in the car and drive it if we're afraid it may explode or the driver's going to crash into something. We cannot transact something in the store if we don't believe in the product or the reliability of the merchant, or if the merchant thinks that our cash is counterfeit. We cannot eat the food if we think it may be rotten. We cannot drink the water unless we have faith that it is pure. We cannot do anything in life. We cannot believe a word anybody tells us. We cannot do anything in life without faith. But the faith that religion tries to give us is faith and belief in a supreme being, a spiritual reality, an infinite, omniscient, omnipotent, and eternal spiritual reality. And it tries to awaken in us a faith in that, a belief in that, and it tries to prepare our mind and prepare our life for relating to that. But religion doesn't have all the answers. It gives us a lot of rules, principles, guidelines, prohibitions. This is what you should eat or not eat. Worship Allah, but don't worship Jesus. Worship Krishna, but don't worship Shiva. You must go around the temple seven times in this direction, not that direction, because if you go in that direction, you will undo everything you got in the other direction. You must light so many sticks of incense, and you must chant the mantra so many times. So many laws are there. Laws for sleeping, laws for waking, laws for eating, laws for talking, laws for everything. Religion is trying to create a code book for reaching spiritual realization, but no individual ever has reached God, discovered God by following any code book or any set of rules. It has helped us civilize ourselves. It has helped us live together more harmoniously. It tells us, don't kill. Though sometimes God says you have to kill. But religion says you shouldn't kill. Don't lie. Don't steal. Don't think about the other man's wife. Don't think about the other man's property. All the rules it has given us. But no man, however good those rules are, however valuable those rules are, however noble they are, no one has ever evolved and discovered spirit by following rules, by using the incense, by sitting for 1 hour in the morning and 1 hour in the evening, or going and standing in the river, or by any other means. But those who discovered religion, created religion, originally they did it with a real inspiration. What was the inspiration? They had an inspiration. There's something more here. It's not just matter, life, and mind. We're not alone on this planet. We're not alone in this universe. There's something greater. We have to find it. That intuition, that spiritual intuition, and trying to find a way to find it. How do you find what's invisible? Even when we have life divine right before us, it's not so easy to get the knowledge from life divine. How to find the spirit, how to realize the spirit. Man has invented so many ways and help for us. Over time, the man who has actually realized spirit, he's had an experience, he's a great soul. He's open to the divine in some way, and other people say, Swami, 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 help me. I also want a blessing. Tell me how I can also do it. He doesn't know what to say. He doesn't know how God has come in his heart. He doesn't know how the vision has come. But he says, you do what I do. You follow what I do. You sit here. You listen. I will tell you what I know. I'll give you a mantra. You do so many things. And not because he does all those things, but because he has faith and because the yogi has a real spiritual touch, he helps somebody, he enlightens somebody. When I'm here with you, I feel very peaceful, I feel inspired, I feel enlightened. There's heart, light in the mind, there's love in the heart. People come to him. Over time, he wants to spread. How do we spread this? How do you spread this message? Not everybody can come and sit by and listen to the Rishi. Not everybody can be blessed. So you give some rules. You give some practices. Gradually it spreads. The more it spreads from the original inspiration of the spiritual man, the more it becomes a set of rules. You should wear this color. You should get up at this time. You should repeat it this many times. And it becomes more and more fixed. And eventually, when man becomes more mental, as happened in the West, he begins to look at all of these external practices, the big churches, the big temples, and the synagogues, the millions of idols, the millions of different versions, Krishna, the different names for God and everything. It's all bewildering to him. What all is this nonsense? How many gods you have? Make up your mind. Is there one? Is there a million? All of this doesn't make any sense. So he says, no, let's simplify the whole thing. Be a good man, work hard, pray, be truthful, don't worry about all of these other things. And then eventually the more mind looks at religion, the more it says this is all silly nonsense and superstition, and it throws it away and says, after all, to be spiritual means to be a good man, to be an honest man. That's it. We forget spirit. The mind ignores the spirit that started the whole thing and just says, here's a good set of laws and practices to be. And eventually science replaces religion and we throw out religion altogether. And this is to a large extent what's happened. And that's what happened when the Englishman came to India, because he couldn't make anything of the religion here. What God? You talk about oneness. We only see you have million gods here. And everybody has a different set of beliefs and a different set of practices. Sri Aurobindo says the genius of Indian religion was that it recognizes that everybody has a unique path to the spirit. That there is no one truth of the spirit. The spirit is truth. But the spirit is a million-sided truth. What does the mountain look like? It depends on from which angle you see it. If you go from this side of the mountain, it looks like a man. If you go from that side, it looks like the face of a woman. If you go from that side, it looks like a bird. If you go from that side, it looks like a flower. And actually, each time you move a little around, you see something else. If you go at night, it looks different than when you go in the dawn or in the middle of the day. If you go in the winter, it looks different than in the summer. So, which is the truth? The truth is, it depends from which angle you're looking, and we are each looking at a different angle. And the genius of Indian religion was that it recognized each person has a unique path to God. Each person will approach it in a different way. So there cannot be any one dogma or one practice or one version for everybody. And that's why the spirituality was there in Indian religion for thousands of years. What about in the integral yoga? What is Sri Aurobindo and Mother say? They didn't come here to found a religion. They came here for spiritual evolution. But what about in the integral yoga? What is it that we, how do we relate to them through something that could be called religious? They tell us, forego all the traditional ceremonies. As long as you belong to the tradition, you cannot tread this path. But then we do make new traditions, no? We have Prosperity Day. We celebrate birthday. We have our own traditions. We have meditation. We have Life Divine talks. We have so many things. Some of it are informal. Some of them are more formal. They can all be a help. Everyone can be a help, but none of them is spiritual experience. Their value is not, you see, this year I have gone to every prosperity. I have given offering, which is something good. I do Pushpanjali. I do book service. All of these things are very good, but what are they good for? Are they good in themselves? I came and I sit for an hour, 1 hour every time. Is there any virtue in the hour? You know, Appa talks so much about hourly consecration. You know what I found? I'm sure many of you may have found this. It's not so difficult to remember the hour. What's difficult is to remember to consecrate on the hour. So sometimes I congratulate yourself. You see, I remembered every hour on the hour. But what did I remember? I remembered the hour. The whole purpose is not to remember the hour. The whole purpose is to remember the divine. Even when I remember the hour, I know there's something more I'm supposed to do. 12 o'clock is not the goal. After all, if you tell a scientist that why are you constantly looking at your watch? I'm remembering the hour every hour. Why are you remembering the hour when you have a clock? Your phone has a clock. Everything has a computer has a clock. Everybody's got a watch. Why are you remembering the hour? No, I want to have a divine spiritual realization. What does this have to do with that? On the hour, we're supposed to remember Mother. On the hour when we remember Mother, we're supposed to consecrate ourselves to Mother, which is really difficult. But no, I sit for meditation every day. I sit for an hour. I remember, I consecrate this. I read so many pages of that. But these are only means to an end. by themselves, they are only ceremony. They're only going through the motions. What is the purpose? The purpose of every, why do we give offerings? Oh, giving offering is good. The purpose is not giving offering. The purpose is giving ourselves. Why do we do service? Service, you're sweeping the floors. It's very good. It is good. It is good. But why is it good? It's good because we are giving ourselves to something else. I am responsible for this work. I'm responsible for the account. Somebody's responsible for the book. Something's responsible. Why is it valuable? Anything religious, anything external has value in the measure what? In the measure it leads us to something beyond that. It's only a means. The value is in we're trying to reach something else. We're trying to reach a reality which we cannot touch. We cannot see, which we cannot achieve by any amount of work. We're trying to reach spiritual experience. We're trying to reach mother's consciousness. We're trying to let that into our life. But it's much easier to remember on the hour than to remember why we're remembering on the hour. And it's easier to do all the services which are good and even to give the offering. Oh, yes, I gave the offering. Now I have done what I should do. This is what I wanted to do. I have done it. I feel good. But do I know why I have given it? What am I trying to give? It's not money Mother needs. Mother needs us. To give of ourselves, to give of our consciousness. Because money's important to me, I give it. Because my energies are there, it's the only way I can give. I give my thoughts to Mother. I give my emotions to Mother. I give my work to Mother, my energies to Mother. Of my physical possessiveness and selfishness, I give to Mother. Because why? Because I want more material things. Because I want to be more important. Because I want something else. That none of these things can give, I want Mother. That's the purpose of our religion. And all that Mother says about cleanliness and honesty, it's very good to say I'm honest, I don't tell any lies. It's very good to say that I'm harmonious with everybody. That's all very good. I speak very softly because that's one of the rules. No? But why are these rules valuable? If everybody known that, you must be one of these Mother devotees, how do you know? Because you speak very softly. Maybe there's some group of people who they write very small. So Appa writes very small. The older he's getting, the smaller he's writing. Maybe we should all be writing very, very small. Sometimes it's so small even he can't read what he's written. Oh, you think if I write very small, I will be more spiritual? Whatever we do, it must be for a purpose. Nothing is good in itself or right in itself. Everything is right and good because it has a purpose. Religion can help us a lot to move towards spiritual experience, but it can never be a substitute for it. And the moment it becomes an end in itself, you're not speaking softly. You're not writing small. You're not going around this many times. You skipped one. The moment we mistake that for what's valuable, you didn't sit for an hour thinking about breakfast or whatever. The moment we think that that's what's important, we have become just religious. That's what we have forgotten. The purpose of this is not a set of rules. It's not to be obedient. It's not, then we're just another religious group. The purpose of this is to reach Mother's consciousness. In cleanliness, we're more receptive to Mother's consciousness. When we tell lies, Mother's consciousness rushes to the other side of the world. It can't come near us. We can't get near Mother. When we're quarreling with people, jealous of people, criticizing people, Mother's consciousness leaves the room. So following these rules helps us to become receptive, to get in touch with it. But they're not an end in themselves. And if I feel satisfied because I follow all the rules, then I'm a good member of a religion, and I qualify myself, maybe in the next birth or in 10 births later, maybe I qualify myself for spiritual experience. But the rules themselves don't give spiritual experience. The second power, he says, is occultism. Occultism is to discover that the real sources of power in the world are not external. They're not machines. They're not technology. They're not guns. They're not even our physical work. The real powers in the work in the world are subtle. Life is a power. It is the power of life that has populated the world that was vacant and empty when it was only a desert and mountains. Mind is a power. It's the power of mind that has created so many things. But occultism has discovered that the powers of life and mind we are using are very superficial. It's just the external. The real power we have as human beings is far greater. It's infinitely greater. It's there in our inner mind, our inner vital. It's there in the occult planes, the subliminal planes, and it's higher powers beyond that. And that is what we need. What do we know of occultism in the integral yoga? Appa is constantly reminding us the outer is a reflection of the inner. We don't need to do black magic or white magic in order to be occultists. When I understand that the problems outside are a reflection of the problems inside and that I can change that by changing this, when I understand that that man or woman who is so angry or so difficult and causing me so many problems, the goal is not to strangle them. The goal is to change that in myself, and they will leave. Either they will change or they will leave. That's the power. That's the occult power. To know that anything we want to create, anything we want to achieve, can be achieved by an inner change. That's spiritual occultism. When Lizzie says, I want to be mistress of Pemberley, Darcy comes. When every time life responds to us, we are using an inner power. Life response is occult power. It's power of life. It's not spiritual. If Lizzie gets Darcy to come, after all, she gets marriage. She gets Pemberley. It's good. It's better than going after him and asking him to marry her. She brings him. That's good. Darcy, by his change of attitude, gets Lizzie to come to Pemberley. It's not spiritual power they're using. It's an occult power of life. Most of the life responses we get are life responses. They're life experiences. They're life powers. They're not spiritual. It's not spiritual experience. But to know the answer lies with us rather than outside, to know that the real progress in our life will come by inner change, is a spiritual knowledge. It prepares us. Occultism and life response are not spiritual experience, but they're a preparation. Because it teaches us, it prepares us to know that the most important changes we can make and things we can do are inside. By turning our thoughts to the divine, by turning our emotions to divine, by purifying our pulses and our sensations, we can bring not just marriage and life and job and wife and other things, we can bring the spirit. We can bring mother's consciousness into our life. That is the real life response we need. That is the knowledge we need. Then there is the power of our mind, the power of our intellect, which in tradition has created, in Indian tradition, has created great philosophies. Great metaphysical, religious, spiritual philosophies to help us understand. And Sri Aurobindo, in the integral yoga, he has given us life divine with unimaginable knowledge. He has told us about the future. He has told us about how we have evolved up until now. He has told us about all the knowledge as a mental knowledge about the truth of our being and the truth of our future. And he's even told us how to evolve in synthesis and in life divine. He's told us what we can do to evolve the spiritual human being and beyond that. He has told us the truth about mind, that mind is an instrument of ignorance. It's very important for us. If we think we're going to discover spirit and become spiritual by mind, we're going to be doing it for a long time. He has told us mind is incapable of seeing the spirit. Mind can see the finite. The spirit is infinite. Or mind can see one form of the spirit and think it's everything. Whereas the spiritual reality we are after is infinitely great, and mind can never know that whole thing. Mind, if it has a spiritual experience, life disappears. And it decides to give up life. It can't see. This is spirit. Life is also spirit. So he's told us the problems of our instrument of mind. That's a great knowledge, but it's itself not spiritual experience. He's told us that we use a logic in our thinking. The divine also has a logic. But ours is the logic of the finite, and the divine's logic is the logic of the infinite. It teaches us not to judge the actions of the divine by the actions of by the logic of our mind, because our mind cannot comprehend it. Now we're spending a lot of time reading about the Detective Sambhu. And the more I read it, the more I feel closer to a knowledge, because the Detective Sambhu, he defies all of the logic of the normal thinking mind. According to the logic of the thinking mind, Sherlock Holmes is a great detective. He has knowledge, he has energy, he has courage, he can work 24 hours a day. He knows everything about the criminals, he knows everything about the science of detection. He's so bold, it's no wonder that he succeeds. But when I read the stories of Detective Sambhu, Holmes is almost a genius, Sambhu's an idiot. Holmes has spent his whole life studying criminology, the different types of soil, the different types of footprints. He knows fingerprints. He knows blood types. He knows so many things, the different types of cigars and ash and everything, the different weapons, the different poisons. He knows so much. Sambhu knows nothing. He only read some detective novels. Holmes is capable of working 24 hours a day. Sambhu will be happy to sleep and eat for 24 hours a day. Holmes is so courageous, he'll go after the criminal. Sambhu, the first time he came in touch with a murderer, he said, I'm giving up this. He ran back to Madras. I don't want this. I'm a fool forever. He's so nerveless. He's so timid. And yet, he also accomplishes. Something that's been very striking to me, I've wondered for a long time. See, the Westerner, for the last 500 years, he's been working very hard. He's been studying science. He's been creating so many technologies and machines. He works 20 hours a day. He goes for more and more education. He does all of these things. He's built these big cities and has worked so hard for hundreds of years to create prosperity. And all this time, the Arabs are sitting there in the desert, just under the oasis, under the palm trees, or in their tents. And the Westerner comes there and says, you see, you have oil here. We'll help you find it. We'll pump it out for you. And without doing anything, their prosperity has gone. You see Dubai, it looks more modern than New York City. Nobody ever asks, how is it possible? This man is like Holmes, this is like Sambhu. But they both get rich. How do you explain it? This doesn't follow the same logic as that. So something we should understand, he tells us, don't judge in Life Divine, he tells us, don't judge the infinite by the terms of the finite. It'll escape every time. And every time I try to make sense of Sambhu, I feel that something's escaping. Appa constantly quotes that line in Life Divine, the unknowable formulates itself to the human consciousness, and then it withdraws. Just at the point when you think, now I understand, this is God, this is spirit, just at that point, then it vanishes. No, it's something else. Because mind cannot grasp that unknowable. He tells us about the illusion of quantity and quality. He tells us the whole infinite is there in each small thing. How can infinity be there in a small thing? Infinity is very big. In Savitri, he has that line that he squandered eternity on a beat of time. How can eternity be there in a beat of time? A beat of time is very small. Eternity is very large. But he says the whole of eternity is there in each moment. Meaning, every moment anything can happen. Everything can happen. In every finite situation, the whole infinite possibility is there. He gives us a great knowledge in Life Divine. He tells us that contradictions are complements, that all problems of life are problems of harmony, that the highest, the earliest aspiration of man is the final destination that we're going to get. He tells us that matter, this dumb, inconscient matter, is Satchidananda. He tells us that spirit concealed in itself. He tells us even that ignorance and falsehood and evil are only limitations of spirit, not the opposite. They're not opposite. Evil is not the opposite of good. He says evil is circling, is good circling around itself to reveal a greater good. Pain is only a preparation for greater joy. All of this he gives us in Life Divine, and all of this is very valuable for knowledge to prepare us. But it's not spiritual experience. Religion, occultism, life response, intellectual knowledge is not spiritual experience. When I first met Appa 40 years ago, we were talking about Indian development, and he said that foreign aid is bad for development. At that time, the whole world believed, India believed, the only way we can develop is if foreign aid. If the Westerner gives us everything, then we can develop. That's not development, that's charity. He said, the only person who is helped by charity is the person who gives because he feels like he's doing something good. Maybe he becomes a little generous, but ego gets puffed up like Lady Catherine. The person who receives the charity only becomes more dependent on the other person. So charity never leads to development of the person. So he says in one of his notes on Life Divine, he says, intellectual understanding is like charity. Intellectual understanding? You mean what? The Westerner thinks charity is very good. They gave Mother Teresa the Nobel Prize because she was charitable. Mother never believed in it. Appa says it cancels. It hurts the other person. It doesn't help them. And now he says intellectual understanding is like charity. Why? Then I understood. Because the moment I understand something in Life Divine, I have a sense of satisfaction. The moment I understood that. I understood that. See, I understood. What is it that ego? I feel a satisfaction. Did I realize? Did I have the spiritual experience? I have satisfied with having the intellectual understanding. Intellectual understanding is not spiritual experience. I may read Life Divine, I may memorize it, I may be able to recite it. There may somebody who can recite the Upanishads or the Gita, but what's valuable is not being able to understand it. What's valuable is the spiritual experience. They can be aids, but they are not the thing itself. They can be preparations, and they can be valuable preparations. Mm-hmm. But what we want is something beyond them. We want the fourth. Is Daddy? Spiritual experience. Yes, Ashok.
You are saying aid is not helpful in the end. But, you see, the Western European nations after World War II, they recovered only because of the American Marshall Aid. Do you mean to say that the Western European countries would have refused Marshall Aid and then I fail to understand how they could have ever regained their prosperity?
I don't know if you could all hear Ashok's question. His question is, you say that aid is not good, but the Western European countries after World War II, they all developed because of the foreign aid from America called Marshall Plan. So how do you reconcile this? Well, actually, Appa has said for a long time, you remember before World War II, Europe was the center of the world. Europe governed the whole world. They were the leaders in the whole world. Britain, France, Germany, these were the Italy, Spain, these were the countries with colonies all over the world. Now, nobody ever thinks of Europe. We can go there. We can see them. But nobody, Europe has lost its leadership. Whereas Russia, before World War II, it was nothing. But when America offered foreign aid with conditions, Russia didn't accept it. Russia became a superpower. What we achieve on our own merit, on our own self-reliance, by our knowledge, by our hard work, creates development. Europe recovered quickly because they had the Marshall Plan. They lost their independence, they lost their self-reliance, they lost their self-respect. As a result, and they have never gained it back. And we cannot say that Europe would never have developed without the Marshall Plan aid. That's not a fact. We can only say it if Russia developed from a very backward, much very poor, primitive condition without the Marshall Plan aid, Europe would have developed. Maybe it would have taken them 2 or 3 or 5 more years to get up, and they would have struggled for a harder time. They would be far more advanced today if they hadn't taken the easy way out. The aid was an easy way out. It was a short-term convenience. Rather than grow food, I borrow it or take it from somebody else. But we cannot say that they would never have developed without it. That's not factual. It's a good question, Michelle. So now we come to
analogy. Perhaps it's possible that a student of spirituality who refuses to avail of the services of a guru will accomplish more in the long run than a student who takes the guidance of a guru. What you are saying amounts to pretty much like that.
Well, I was giving an analogy. You're applying an analogy as a universal truth, that you have to be a little careful of that. Analogy means there's a similarity and relationship. It doesn't matter, mean that everything is the same. Then it's like, by the same analogy, you might say that infants who depend on their parents for their survival, for their food, and for their shelter, they may struggle a little more, but they'll be much better if they give up their parents. That's not what I have said. The child without the parent will die. It will never grow up. So be careful about generalizing an analogy. I've used it in one place. Doesn't mean the same analogy applies everywhere. Sri Aurobindo says that the guru has an important place in the Shastra. The guru has an important place in the spiritual tradition. But he says you shouldn't be limited. You're not limited. The soul is never limited. He says the real guru is the inner divine. Every Shastra can offer you something at a particular time, but the real Shastra is the truth that you can discover inside. That's what he says in a synthesis. So we can use anything. It doesn't mean that you can never have spiritual experience without it. Sri Aurobindo had the guru Lele for 3 days. One session, the man said, told him how to reject thoughts from his mind. 3 days later, he came back and his mind was silent. And Lele said, oh, this is some magic or something like that, some instrument of the devil. The Lele himself ran away. Sri Aurobindo had a guru. He had for 3 days. And the rest he did himself. So be careful of the way you use an analogy, and the conclusions may be different. There is a truth in a guru. Doesn't mean that you cannot realize without the outer guru. There is a value in any scripture. Sri Aurobindo himself read all of the scriptures and studied them, but we shouldn't be limited by them. Then we come to, okay?
I'm satisfied.
Thank you. Then we come to the fourth aid, which is spiritual experience. The fourth aid for what? Isn't spiritual experience the end of everything? Isn't that the end? Religion, occultism, philosophy are there to bring us spiritual experience. But Sri Aurobindo says spiritual experience itself is only a means to an end. He's talking about the evolution of the spiritual man. Well, isn't the evolution of the spiritual man spiritual experience? Spiritual experience is an aid and a step and a help and a path to the evolution of the spiritual man, but it's not the same thing. What is spiritual experience? When I sit in meditation, when I pray intensely to Mother and my prayer is answered, I get the job, my problem is solved. It's a spiritual experience. I see the power of spirit acting outside in my life. I'm not really experiencing the spirit, but I'm experiencing a power of the spirit by my prayer. But when you sit in meditation, when you call Mother, when you feel peace coming and settling into the nerves, some of you see light coming in the mind, joy or love coming in the heart or in the nerves, sweetness filling the body. Those are spiritual experiences. They're not the spirit. They are spiritual experiences. They are not the spirit itself. We hear the voice of Mother. We see the photo of Mother. Hearing Mother's voice is a spiritual experience. Seeing Mother, knowing Mother, knowing what Mother is, realizing Mother is something more. But any our valuable spiritual experiences, when we feel that peace or that joy, we know Mother is real. She hears us. We know when we feel that sweetness in our nerves, in our body, we know that Mother is real. Her power is real. Her consciousness is real. And we want more of it, and we call more and more of it. And the sage who brings down and sees the touch of spirit in his mind, gets the illumination in his mind, he becomes the sage. The person whom the spirit touches in the heart, in the emotions of the heart, he becomes the devotee. The person in whom the inner divine reveals itself as a reality, not just as an experience, where it actually sees the inner divine there, he becomes a rishi, a yogi. He knows, he doesn't just experience, he knows the reality. The reality becomes directly real to him. And that is the end according to tradition. Once you have seen the inner divine, once you have discovered and experienced the transcendent divine, you have reached the end of the line. When we see the psychic, the person who has realized the psychic, awakened the psychic, and the psychic comes out and radiates in his inner heart, he's the saint. The yogi and the rishi, they're liberated from, they're no longer identified with the mind, the body, and the physical. They know their real reality is something else. It's the self. It's the spirit. They have real spiritual realization, not just spiritual experience. They have realized the spirit. Sri Aurobindo says in the chapter on self-consecration in Synthesis of Yoga, one of the first chapters, second chapter after the introduction, he says, the realization of the inner divine in oneself, the realization of the cosmic divine, the universal divine that's everywhere, and the realization of the transcendent divine beyond the cosmos. He says this is the first fundamental city of the integral yoga. I remember the first time I read it, my mind couldn't digest. Having read a number of books on yoga and spirituality, any one of these is the highest spiritual experience imaginable in any tradition. He's the realized soul. If you have one of them, you're a realized soul. He says this is the starting point. From here we go. The end of traditional yogic spiritual experience is spiritual realization. Sri Aurobindo says it's the starting point. It's the starting point for what? It's the starting point for spiritual evolution. Why? How can there be something beyond the first fundamental, what he calls the first fundamental city? How can there be something beyond the inner, discovering the inner divine, discovering the universal divine, discovering the transcendent divine?
Talking about the point you said, you said that the spirit looks different from different angles. I remember reading about a sadhak who wrote to Sri Aurobindo saying integral yoga was difficult for him to follow. Sri Aurobindo wrote back to him saying, Why do you want to follow the path I have carved out for myself? Why don't you develop your own path suited to your own personality and go in that path? Why you insist on following my path? No, I don't understand why a man should take trouble to develop his own path when there is already a path laid out, ready-made for him. Why this unnecessary trouble to develop a path suited to his own nature? This is when somebody has already done that work.
And Sri Aurobindo has also said that you can follow any path, you can follow all paths. The problem, every path has its validity. Every religion has its validity. Every practice has its validity for the particular soul at the particular moment in time. Every truth has its validity. The problem is, the key is not to be limited by any of them. The problem with all discoveries, all religions, all truths is that they claim to be the whole thing. All our fractions, all our tiny rays of an infinite reality. We shouldn't stop in the middle. That's his message. I know the quotes you're giving about Sri Aurobindo, but you have to put it in a context. If I want to go from here to America or from here to Hyderabad, I look at a map and I follow the map. Why should I look at a map? I will find it myself. So many people have been to Hyderabad, I will find it myself. I may end up going around the world and coming back through Delhi. I may eventually find it in this life or another life. Well, if I want to say I found Hyderabad as if I'm discovering America for the first time, I can have that satisfaction. You say, why shouldn't you use a map? Yes. If the map can take you to Hyderabad, why shouldn't you use it? It's common sense. Well, as long as you're using the map and it's taking you towards the destination you want to go, it's common sense to use it. It's a good aid. When the map ends at a dead end and it doesn't tell you how to go further, if you're going to insist on the map, all the maps up until now end with the first fundamental city of the integral yoga. Sri Aurobindo never said you can't use them. He said don't be limited by them. Use any shastra, but the real truth you should be seeking is the truth that's there in your own inner heart. Follow any guru. But the real ultimate guru for you is the divine in your heart, is the living divine in your heart. You need not be limited to that. It doesn't mean you should discard all the aids along the way. He never says that. He says don't be limited by it. Because each soul is unique. There can never be one path. There can never be one map for each of us. Sri Aurobindo and Mother have come to show the way, to carve a path, but each soul is here to do something unique, to manifest something unique. They have not given the whole map. They have given the path and the measure, the methods to go, and they will help each discover on the way that unique path. The unique path is, what should I do the next moment? They don't tell us in Life Divine what I should do the next moment, what I should say the next moment, where I should go, how I should consecrate. They have given us the tools. They've given us the principles. They've given us the knowledge. They've given us the practices. It is for each to follow the inspiration. And we know when we follow a rule or a practice without the inner inspiration, we're just going through the motions. The method they have given is consecration. Appa says, I went back and read the first paper I ever read of Appa. It was the thing that brought me to meet him the first time. Was the paper he wrote in 1972 on consecration. I had read all of Sri Aurobindo and Mother at that time, but when I read consecration, I thought I knew so much about Mother and Sri Aurobindo. When I read this paper on consecration, I thought, what is all my reading? I have not understood the most basic thing. Appa has told us how to make this knowledge alive in our hearts and alive in our life. I didn't have that knowledge. It's there in Mother and Sri Aurobindo, but I didn't have the capacity to take it out. Should I say, I have the knowledge, I have read Sri Aurobindo, so I won't read anybody else? So I went back and read it 44 years later. I realized I still don't have that knowledge that he had. What was real to him 44 years ago, which he gave me, which was so inspiring, I found it equally inspiring today. Because for him, it's a living knowledge out of his experience. He says a consecrated act generates freshness. Everything I do, which I think is following Mother, when I give an offering, does it make me feel fresh? When I do a service, does it make me feel fresh? When I read Life Divine, does it make me feel fresh? When I call Mother, is it a live, real act for me? Am I really calling Mother or am I repeating her name? Am I remembering the hour or am I really remembering Mother? If I'm really remembering Mother, at each hour, there should be a freshness, a bloom of freshness. By the end of the day, I should be charged with energy. I have felt that. But not always. How to make it live? So Mother and Sri Aurobindo, that's why he wrote the chapter, Self-Consecration. He's given us a method.
Yes.
Huh?
How do you expect anybody to feel fresh when they are doing routine things like taking bath or taking breakfast or putting on their dress? These are very routine acts that people do every day. How is it possible any freshness can be introduced?
Essentially, you're asking the question, a very good question. The topic of this chapter is spiritual evolution. And that's the question I started with. What is spiritual evolution? Clearly, taking a bath is not spiritual evolution. I think we all agree. And cleaning the floor is not spiritual evolution. And cooking the food or eating the food or reading Life Divine are not spiritual evolution. The question is, how can we convert taking the bath, cleaning the floor, cooking the food, eating the food, or reading Life Divine or anything else into an act of spiritual evolution? And what is spiritual evolution? That's the real question that we have to answer in this chapter. What does it mean for the spirit to evolve? All this time, if I'm calling Mother because I want a job or I want a better marriage alliance or if I want a better admission or if I want a bigger house or something like that, it's not spiritual evolution, it's my evolution. It's Gary's evolution. I want the divine to serve me. I want the divine to give me more. Very good. It's good that we know that Mother can give us anything. That's very valuable knowledge. But that's not spiritual evolution. That's our evolution as social people in life, in society. Makes like Sambhu becoming more important or more successful or more rich or more self-satisfied like Lady Catherine. That's our individual personal progress. That's not spiritual evolution. It took me a long time to understand. A long time means about 40 years, not 4 months. To understand by spiritual evolution, he's not talking about my evolution to become spiritual. He's talking about the evolution of the spirit. He's talking about the divine's evolution. All this time, I thought that Sri Aurobindo was about a path for my spiritual progress. This is a book about the progress, spiritual progress of the spirit. And the first thing that we should understand is we are not here for our progress. We're here for the progress of the Spirit. We're not here for our satisfaction, for our achievement. We're here to give ourselves for the glory of the Spirit. And that's the truth of consecration. Consecration is not to do something so I will get more, so I will become more successful. That's prayer. Consecration is to do something for the glory of the divine. Consecration is our giving ourselves to the divine. Consecration is to make an act sacred. An act is not sacred as long as it's done for my sake. As important as I may think I am, and as much as I want to get more for myself, that's not being sacred. Sacred is what I give to Mother, not what I take from Mother. Consecration is the means for us to allow the Spirit to evolve in us. And what is that Spirit? That Spirit is our true self. There is no difference between my progress and the progress of the Spirit, because my real self is the Spirit. Giving myself to Mother, consecrating my acts to the divine, is really giving myself to my true self. So my individual progress and the progress of the Spirit manifesting in the world are not different. They're the same. But it's not the progress of my ego. It's not the self-importance of Mrs. Bennett or Lady Catherine or Darcy or Lizzie. It's the progress of the Spirit inside. That is the purpose of the spiritual evolution. And that evolution of the spiritual man, the spiritual person, comes only when... Not only is there a divine reality, that's our reality. That's what we should seek, not this. And everything we do should be dedicated and consecrated to that. Then we are moving towards that. Then we become an instrument for that. Then Mother comes not just to give us what we want. Mother comes to enter our body, to enter our mind, to enter our hearts, to become us. Rather, for us to become her, to be filled with her more and more until we're not separate, until we're our life, what she wants and what we like want are no longer different. What we want is only her. She gives us everything we want. That's different. But what we really want is only her. What we want is the joy of feeling her presence in our body. What we want is the light of her in our mind. What we want is the love overflowing, her love overflowing out of our heart to her and to everything all around us. All we want is her. That is spiritual evolution, because it's spirit. Yes.
How consecration will make the experience of taking tea in the morning every day a different experience every day? To me, taking tea in the morning every day, it always tastes the same. I don't find any difference.
Yes. And
to say that if I consecrate the act of drinking tea every morning, it will taste different or something. I don't follow how that difference will come about.
Well, anybody who can really consecrate their taking tea every morning, I congratulate them. Let's not worry about doing it every morning. Try really consecrating taking tea even once and see the experience. One act, fully consecrated, is no longer taking tea. What the tea tastes like or anything is absolutely immaterial. You'll be a different person. No question about it. Whether you can repeat that or not is another thing. Consecration is to move from the small, narrow surface center to discover, to relate ourselves to Mother's infinite consciousness and to allow that to express in the act. In the measure we do it, I don't know if I have ever really successfully consecrated taking a cup of tea, but whatever I have successfully consecrated in some measure, and I think many of you or all of you have your own experience. She narrated a very good experience. I won't repeat the whole thing, but the essence is when she saw that her son's behavior caused a problem because he was following the advice of so many people, she realized that in her own life, she has followed the advice of so many people, and she started to consecrate that. And that gave an inner opening, not just a little freshness on the surface, but a psychological opening, which is at a much deeper level. And after 2 days of that experience, her son reversed himself in his idea. That is a deep freshness. Ashok's question was, can consecration bring freshness to drinking the cup of tea? Consecration can bring freshness to a marriage that's been going on for 50 years, and suddenly it can become fresh. The most routine thing, the job that's been so boring, the thing that you don't like to do, it can, the point is not whether drinking tea can become fresh. The goal of life is not that to drink tea and be fresh. The goal of life is to become fresh in everything we do. To unlock that freshness, we have to move from habit. What do we mean by consecration? Every act we do with ourselves as the center. Every act I do because my mind thinks it's good, or because I want my, I desire something and I want to satisfy it, or I want to increase my comfort, or I'm acting out of habit. When I do what my mind thinks is good, or what's pleasing to my vital, or what's comfortable to my body, or what's an expression of my habit, I'm not being fresh. I'm not relating to mother, even if it's meditation that I'm doing. I'm expressing my nature. I'm not evolving. If I can take any act and do it not for the sake of my mind or my heart or my vital or my physical or myself, if I can do it for the sake of mother, any act, even if it's reading one sentence in Life Divine or speaking one thing to another person, when we can do it for the sake of mother to make an offering to her, to make it sacred by giving it to her, in that act, for 1 second or 1 minute or 1 day or whatever it is, becomes an act of evolution for us. Consecration, spiritual evolution, that's the topic of this chapter. What is the method? How do we evolve? How does the spirit evolve? It evolves when we move out of our nature, when we let the spirit emerge out of the nature. When I act out of my understanding, when I act out of my emotional preferences, when I act out of my vital urges, when I act because it's comfortable, I'm not evolving. It's me acting. When I say I want mother to act, I want the divine to enter my act, I want the divine to express in my act, I want the results to go to mother, not to me, it becomes an act of spiritual evolution. Consecration is a means to make every act an act of spiritual evolution, or any act. We may do it and becomes a habit like everything else. We do it for a minute. If you do it successfully for a minute, there'll be a rush of energy or a fullness of emotion or joy or warmth in the heart or joy in the nerves or energy in the body or a light in the mind. That is an evolutionary act at that moment. how once we've done it at one level and got the result, how to extend it, how to deepen it, how to carry it to more acts in the life, how to take it to deeper levels. That's what he discusses in that article. He knew it all 45 years ago. He was practicing the whole thing at that time. It is a map that anybody can use for their spiritual evolution. Wherever we are, it doesn't matter. Normally, a map is good only if it has your starting point and your destination. A map of India won't help me when I'm in North America. I need consecration as a map to tell us wherever we are, this is how we can move towards spirit. It's a compass. At every minute, how we can move towards spirit. In our thought, in our feeling, in our sensation, in our action. If we do it once fully, we will feel we are moving there. If we lose it the next minute, anyway, we know the map, we know the direction, we know the method. It's for us to renew it. He says there in that article, consecration completes what aspiration initiates. Without aspiration, there can be no consecration. Aspiration is to want the divine. When we want the divine, we want to know how to go, how to realize that. It's fine, I want mother, but how to realize? How do we know how to realize mother? He's given us the method. Offer your thoughts to mother. Offer your feelings to mother. Offer your acts to mother. She will come to you. You don't have to find her. You don't have to go hunting for her. She's not far away. When you offer to her, she will come. She will enter your mind, your heart, your body, your soul. She will bring it out. So consecration completes what aspiration initiates. And it leads to surrender. The goal, the secret of spiritual evolution, the secret of the supramental transformation, which he's going to talk about in the next chapter, the real method of the spiritual evolution. The next chapter is the triple transformation. He's going to talk about this. This is all the preparation for the spiritual evolution, for the transformation, for what the divine really intends to lead to the life divine. The method he discovered for that, the secret he discovered was there's only one method. It's surrender. Surrender to the highest is your sure roadmap towards the spiritual future. Start with aspiration. Use consecration as your means. Make surrender the goal. Surrendering to mother, giving yourself to mother, giving your thoughts, your feelings, your sensations, your whole self, your whole being, and everything you are, body, mind, and soul to mother. That's the only method we need. Mother comes and takes us and becomes us, and that's the rest is her work.